This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. We're here for our week in review program. What a week this has been. We've got a lot of important news to discuss. It's been a huge week. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. I've got Robert Morley.
Hello.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi.
We have Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal is not here, but he did me the favor of granting an interview with me yesterday that we'll include in the program. So he's with us in spirit. So we've got a lot to cover here, gentlemen. I'd say we had maybe four stories this week that we, on any normal week, would have easily considered our top story. Now, we're going to cover all of these. We've gone with what I would say is a huge story that was probably overwhelmed by so many other headlines in the mainstream press this week. But this is something that we've been anticipating for a long time, and it just exploded in a dramatic way this week. The Greek crisis took an amazing turn, and the story is that essentially Greece has been conquered by Germany. We're going to go straight to our man in the United Kingdom, Richard Palmer, for this story. He contributed to a joint article with the host of the Trumpet Daily radio show, Stephen Fleury. It's up on thetrumpet.com from yesterday. Richard, please bring us up to speed on what happened here.
Okay, yeah, this is an astounding takeover by Germany. So to recap, we talked last week about Greece and their referendum. We talked about how that directly threatened Germany, and that sooner or later, Germany would have to respond quite forcefully to that. And then this weekend, we saw they chose to respond forcefully sooner rather than later. You know, had Germany given in to Greece, the economic dominance that they'd built up for years would be at risk. And so they really shocked the world by how forcefully they came out and cracked down on what was on Greece here. And I remember just coming home Saturday evening, catching up on some of the news today, and just there was this note of astonishment from all the economic commentators that I was reading. They were really shocked and taken aback by how firm Germany was being. And they were saying things like, well, this is Wolfgang Schäuble. He's always the bad cop. We'll see Angela Merkel come out and play nice on Sunday. And then on Sunday, they were shocked as well to see how forceful Miss Merkel was being. They're also surprised at Greece's just about total capitulation. They had their no vote, but now the prime minister and parliament, they've all submitted to these terms dictated to them by Germany. And these are really harsh terms. They give European bureaucrats more power over Greece than the U.S. Constitution gives the president over America.
Wow, that's phenomenal. And this, and like you said, I think the aspect of this that's just stunning to me is the fact that the Greek people said no just a week ago. And now here they are finding themselves being handed these terms.
Yeah, they were backed into a corner. I guess they're not ready to run the risk of leaving the euro. And Germany insisted on a very high price for staying in. So the bureaucrats can now veto laws. They can tell Greece to repeal old laws that don't like. They're essentially confiscating 50 billion worth of Greek assets. And the thing that really, I don't know, it's almost funny, is just the minutia that these laws get into. They're dictating how bread is weighed and sold. They're talking about when supermarkets can open. They're dictating how long milk can sit on the supermarket shelf for. It's almost like a power mad bureaucrat is suddenly going crazy over there.
Well, that really exposes the mindset of these people. These aren't rules that would have anything to do with helping Greece to become economically solvent or pay back debts or anything like that. It's just they just put the squeeze to the Greeks because they can.
That is a good chunk of it. Now, part of it, a lot of these little laws, they do come from they are OECD recommendations. So that's why they're forcing their implementation to try and make the economy more competitive. But there was a clear note of vindictiveness in what happened. There's two things that I really want to emphasize. And the first here is this is about a whole lot more than just Greece. And that's why there was that extra note of vindictiveness. This is about the whole of the Eurozone. Germany had to demonstrate here that if you stand up to Germany, if you try and overturn this economic order that has given Germany so much power, there will be major consequences for you. And in this article, we quoted from Wolfgang Monschau in the Financial Times, where he talked about this. This is not only regime change in Greece, but also regime change in the Eurozone. So this is about sending a message to the voters of Portugal, to the voters of Spain, to the voters of Italy, saying, we saw after the Greek referendum, you were thinking about copying the Greeks. There were all these other political parties that are very similar to the Greek party that's in power. And they were gaining momentum after that Greek referendum. And this was a message to those voters. You try and defy us the way the Greeks did. This is what will happen to you.
That's a huge development. Already, Germany was the leading economy within the Eurozone. But this just takes that to an altogether higher level, doesn't it?
It does. And this is, I think, the second big takeaway from this story, is that this is a very big moment in Germany's history. I really like the way Mr. Flurry put this on his program the other day, where he quoted Bernard Connolly saying the EU has been a cloak for German ambition. But this was the weekend that cloak came off. Since the war, Germany's been worked really hard and bent over backwards in a lot of ways to try not to appear to be the dominant power in Europe. And that ended this weekend. And so I'll just quote from George Friedman, had an excellent article, free to read on Stratfor's website, where he said here, the Germans did something they never wanted to do, resurrect fairly unambiguously the idea that Germany is the sovereign and dominant nation state in Europe and that it has the power and the will to unilaterally impose its will on other nations. And the language he used in that article is really, he talked about German willingness to crush the opposition. This is someone not at the trumpet who saw just the drama and the firmness of what was happening here.
How do these other nations respond to this? How does Spain, how does Italy, how does Portugal respond? Is essentially they see what happened to Greece, and obviously Germany wanted to send a strong message to those nations based on what happened to Greece and make an example of Greece. These other nations, is it essentially that they don't have any real recourse? Is it basically they have to look at this and say, wow, Germany is not messing around, but is it basically that there's nothing that they can do about it?
Well, the first thing is there's a slight difference at the moment, and this will disappear over time, but there's a slight difference, I think, between national interest and the interest of the leaders who are in power. So if you take Spain, the current leadership are fighting against the upstart party that's kind of similar to Greece. And so this gives them a bit of a boost. They benefit in the short term because these new political parties that are threatening them get this big message from Germany, and it will help voters swing behind them. In the long term, though, that isn't so much of a consideration. And I think the only option they would have, and there was some talk about this happening a few years later, is it would be possible perhaps for Spain, for Italy, for France, some of these southern European nations to kind of come together and try and oppose Germany. I don't think that will happen. They've not really shown enough political will to be able to act together aggressively enough to do that. And I think Germany is, you know, France has a lot of incentive to stick with Germany, for example, rather than try and fight. So I don't think it will happen. But there is the potential for a very interesting a very interesting rebellion there. And that, I think, would really be their only option.
So we've been talking about how we expect the entire European project to be built around a dominant Germany and Germany to really take the lead of this whole project. We just saw this week a lurch toward that becoming reality in a dramatic way that I think more dramatic really than probably anything we've seen in years. Mm-hmm. That really demonstrates Germany's control over what's going on over there. And it'll be interesting to watch in the time ahead just how this plays out, what happens with these other nations, or as these other nations kind of come to terms with this new reality.
Yes, and I think the thing to watch for now would be the Catholic Church. I've been writing articles on the Euro crisis for, I guess it's coming up on six or seven years now. And one thing that I've just noticed is whenever Mr. Flurry gets involved and writes on this, he always brings in the Catholic Church as well. And that's the missing ingredient that is really going to be necessary to help these nations come together and get along. So it will take more than German force and what we're seeing in the Euro. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that's one of the next big developments we see in Europe now.
All right, Richard, thank you for that. Before we move on, let's just go ahead and take a quick survey of any other important news from Europe that you saw this week. Can you give us the overview?
Yes, sure. So we had France's foreign minister said that he's going to take a trip to Iran now that with the Iran deal done, they've re-entered the international community. I think there's a lot of potential interesting things about this. One of the most obvious is it does show an increased French involvement in the Middle East. They have been working and being more involved over there, mainly with Iran's enemies, with the Saudis, with the Gulf Arab states. And nonetheless, this just shows a continued French interest in that region. Sticking with France, there was some figures released this week that showed that anti-Semitic attacks are up, about 84%. And while anti-Semitism is surprisingly high among ordinary French people, they don't tend to act on that anti-Semitism. And the ones carrying out the attacks are almost exclusively Muslim. So this increase of attacks is part of a trend that we've talked about on this program before, about an increase of Islamic attacks in Europe. And that's something that Europe will eventually be forced to confront. And then also along these lines, this week there was news that Italy had deported an Islamic State recruiter, and this trend of the Islamic State getting more involved in Europe is also something to watch.
All right. Thanks so much, Richard. The other huge news from this week was the Iranian nuclear deal. We've had a lot of coverage on thetrumpet.com about it this week, but we have to cover it here. We're going to go to our Middle East man, Brent Noctegal, who's written an article about this that's up on thetrumpet.com today. Brent, however, is on assignment at the Philadelphia Youth Camp. This is a summer camp going on our campus where our offices are here. But I managed to snag him yesterday and get him to fill me in on the most important aspect of this story and just the overview of the Middle East. And to talk about this huge development, we're going to go to that segment now. Brent, we have to talk about what's going on in the Middle East, but first I have to ask you the burning question. What in the world are you doing at summer camp right now?
I'm teaching dance to 144 happy campers.
Amazing. They're enjoying themselves.
Yes, and as are we, me and my wife.
Yep. Okay, and in the chances that you have, you're still watching this tinderbox of a region.
Right, I get to come in every morning and check through the headlines, seeing what's going on. And this week seems to be one of the busiest again in the Middle East. Just a couple of stories that caught my eye. One was that the Iraqi government, with help from Iranian militias or Shiite militias, they're actually starting to take back a little bit of Anbar province that was taken. The capital city was taken, Ramadi was, a couple weeks ago, and they're starting to move in. And see
taken by Islamic State.
Taken by Islamic State, right. And now they're finally initiating this mission, which we think will put more Iranian influence in that region. So there was that. And then there was also a slap in the face to the United States by Iran that they are now fining the United States $50 billion because they have as the Fars news agency says, I'll just quote it, that the U.S. is guilty of killing Iranian nationals by assisting their enemies. So if the U.S. sends arms to a country that does not like Iran and fights against Iranian proxies, apparently they think that they can claim a little bit of cash back for their losses from the United States.
What would that be talking about? Yemen? Saudi Arabia?
I'm not exactly sure. It didn't say in the report.
Wherever it may be,
it could be a number of countries.
That's true. Yeah, the United States is fighting Iranian proxies in a lot of places.
That's right.
So the big story this week, obviously, we've been talking a lot about this nuclear deal. What can you tell us about this story?
The nuclear deal between Iran and Western powers was the biggest news this week, perhaps even this year. They've been going after this for a couple of years. Iran's nuclear program's been going on for 6 or 7 years. And they're finally, the United States government is really happy about this, that they have successfully negotiated a deal that will not allow, according to the United States, Iran to get a bomb. And the world, the lot of journalists, they erupted with applause for this deal, it seems. But there are some that question whether this deal is a good thing, and no doubt we've been doing that for a long time now. And there's just one aspect of the deal I would like to talk about today. The United States president, he had a press conference yesterday, and Mr. Barack Obama talked at length about why he thought it was a great deal. And it was interesting to watch this press conference because he almost was giddy at the opportunity to answer anybody's questions that would have the gall to say it was a bad deal. It got to the point where he was running out of time. And at the end, he's like, okay, fire it at me. Any questions, any other instances where you think this was a bad deal? He was like a salesman of some sort that was trying to sell this deal. And one thing that he said in that deal, and he has been saying for a number of months now, is that this deal would contain the most intrusive and robust inspections regime ever negotiated. He believes that if, in fact, Iran does break the deal, that we will be able to detect it and act immediately.
Yeah, his fundamental point is without a deal, all of this stuff is going to be going on anyway. We make the deal, we get inspectors in there, we have 24/7 monitoring of their major nuclear installations, and we have, 24 days for those places where Iran says we're not really comfortable with 24/7 monitoring here, but what are the details there?
Well, the main sites that we know about, like you say, they are going to have 24 hours a day monitoring in Israel. The nation that you would expect to be most upset about this deal, they're actually okay with that. They think that's a good thing, that the president got a win there, that their facilities, Natanz and Fordo, that they are...
Iraq
as well. Yeah, they will be monitored. But the real bad part of this deal is the fact that what happens if Iran has a secret location where they start to develop nuclear technology and nuclear material.
Which has happened.
Well, yeah. How did Natanz and how did Fordo actually get uncovered? It was because the intelligence community discovered through their spies and such that they were undergoing nuclear activities. It wasn't that Iran came forward and said, hey, everyone, we're developing nuclear weapons. No, these were locations where nuclear work was underway. So it seems reasonable to expect that it would happen again, or that if they did decide to pursue nuclear weapons, that they would do so covertly. Now, if this happens, it sets in motion, and the United States and the international agencies can detect that it's happening. You've got to allow for that point as well. If that happens, then a huge program of back and forth, you go and you tell Iran, the IAEA says to Iran, hey, what are you doing at this site? Iran says, we're doing nothing. Then the International Atomic Energy Agency will say, well, here is our proof. Here is our evidence that we suspect that you are developing nuclear material at this site. They have to turn that over to Iran for inspection, without even putting boots on the ground. At that point, Iran can decide, uh-uh, you're not going in. We disagree with you. We're not doing anything. So then it would go then to the UN Security Council. All of them would have to agree.
Which would include
Russia and China as well, that look like they're happy with the deal, whatever happens going forward. Then it would have to go through them. And if they decide that, yes, we need to go and inspect this site, then at that point, the IAEA apparently would be able to give access, be given access. Now, if everything goes smoothly in this whole process, there is 24 days from the point of, hello, Iran, we think you're doing something bad, to the time that you've got boots on the ground inspecting this site. 24 days to get rid of the material, to demolish the site, and then say, hey, there's nothing here, deniability at some point.
So essentially, Iran has ensured that it has these protocols in place and these protections for itself in order to defend its own military secrets and that type of thing. It's saying we are a legitimate nation. We deserve this kind of privacy as any sovereign state does. And essentially, these other nations acquiesced to that demand.
I think that that would be a justifiable conclusion for Iran to make or to ask of if they hadn't have a history of lies and deceit, of deliberately making it difficult for the IAEA inspectors to look at their sites, if they didn't have a history of having covert sites that were eventually found by intelligence agencies, sure.
Iranian nuclear negotiators openly boasting of having deceived the IAEA and international bodies over this very issue.
Exactly, and the chief one of those was President Rouhani himself back in 2006, 2007. He boasted about the fact that they were deliberately misleading them, that they could still develop nuclear material as the world was trying to come after them to stop.
Yeah, listening to President Obama's defense of the deal, it did strike me how every question that was asked about, well, what about this potential path for Iran to deceive us or to get the path to the bomb? He had an answer for every one, and it seems like ultimately his faith in the ability of the international community to pin all of these things down and the ability to trust Iran to the degree that he's certain that they will not be able to follow through with their intent here. What seems to be a clear intent to want to get nuclear weapons for several reasons, it's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary level of confidence that he has.
Yeah, his whole aim here is resting on the fact that he believes that Iran, it's possible for them to turn over a new leaf, to be get all the money that they will receive when sanctions go away. They'll be flush with cash. They'll enjoy the good times of economic windfall. They'll start going into materialism, and they won't need to build a bomb to increase their regional hegemony. But 35 years of proof since the Islamic takeover in that country should show that especially this government won't do that. They'll stay to the course.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program. We've been talking to trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the news from Iran and the Middle East. And this article that he was talking about is in this week's Trumpet Weekly, a very informative, high-quality report that we put together each week with the most significant stories from around the world. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. You can get it right in your email inbox. Just go to thetrumpet.com. to become a subscriber to the Trumpet Weekly. Coming up, we have news from America and Asia, and later on, our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking for the big stories from around the world this past week. It's been a huge week. We're going to look now at the news from Anglo-America. And for that, we'll turn to trumpet writer Robert Morley. Another huge story to cover here. But before we get into that, let's talk about the overview of news from Anglo-America. Robert?
Sure. I have a couple of stories for you today. China just released their official report on its gold bullion reserves, and a lot of market participants were watching and waiting for this because they hadn't released their holdings since 2009. And according to the Chinese, they've increased their gold reserves by 57%, which I think was bigger than a lot of people were expecting. They've now surpassed Russia in terms of national gold holdings. They have over 1,650 tons officially. A lot of market participants think their actual reserves are even higher than that because they have a history of underreporting a lot of their strategic assets. But the accumulating of gold is part of this trend we're seeing in China as part of their plan to make the yuan a global reserve currency. It's part of their plan to compete with the dollar, and they are starting to make huge strides towards that, as we're seeing with their bullion accumulation. The second story I have for you is that, sadly, abnormally large numbers of Americans are still dependent on food stamps, and beneficiaries of food stamps have exceeded 45 million for 48 straight months now. We first punched through that 45 million food stamp users back in May of 2011 during the Great Recession, and 4 years on, we still haven't recovered from that level. And this is why so many people in America don't think that we really have recovered. They don't feel like we've recovered from that Wall Street meltdown that happened in 2008, 2009. And that's because for many people, they haven't recovered.
All right, Robert, the big news in America this week.
Well, the big news was the shooting at the military facility in Tennessee that happened on Thursday. As you've probably heard, a gunman shot and killed four Marines during two attacks on military facilities in Chattanooga. The gunman has now been identified as Muhammad Yosef Abdulaziz, and yes, he is a Muslim. But unlike the Fort Hood shooting, you remember that from a few years ago when officials called it workplace violence, quote unquote, this time law enforcement is treating it as an act of domestic terrorism. But here's what I find disturbing about this case. Here's a man, an American citizen, who was born in Kuwait and came to America as a baby. And he came to this country, and by all accounts, he was given everything. He was given an education. He went to a good college. He became an electrical engineer. He drove a Mustang. His father was employed by the government. We'll come back to that later. That's a bit sketchy in itself. But by all accounts, here is one of those moderate Muslims that we hear about. He was supposedly westernized. You know, his mosque leader said he was a really great guy. There was no warning signs until recently. And a couple of years ago, he actually, less than that, he was arrested for driving under the influence. According to reports, he was smoking marijuana. The police officer said he had white powder around his nose. He admitted to being at a party with other people doing drugs. This was a guy that a lot of people said had become a very typical young American, not the typical Muslim that you would think of. He was a martial arts instructor.
It's kind of sad that the typical American is a kid that gets caught up in drug scene.
That is terrible. So the question is, what happened to him? Why did he become radicalized? Why did he turn against the country that provided so much for him and his family? And I think it speaks to a couple of things, one of which is the failure of multiculturalism in America, this idea that you can bring people from all around the world, from all kinds of different cultures and backgrounds, and bring them to America, and that they'll check their differences, their historic grievances and animosities at the door and become American. And as we're seeing increasingly, is that that isn't happening. You know, as this guy got older, Muhammad, he grew a beard, the typical Muslim beard. Eventually, he disappeared from his family, from his neighborhood. Reports were he went back to the Middle East. He went to Jordan and possibly elsewhere. So the question is, you know, what happened to this guy? You know, how moderate was he really? And now that reports are starting to come out, they're saying, well, there was a lot of signs that this young man had problems. Even back in high school, he had worrying signs. He wrote in his yearbook that his name came up in government databases and that he caused security alerts, and this was something that bothered him. His parents, there's questions about, you know, how moderate they were. His father was suspected of being a terrorist. He was under investigation from the FBI. So was his family really adopting the American ideals?
Well, like you said, they're not encouraged to do so. Under that multiculturalist model, the more you retain your individual identity, the better off you are. And there, it's almost treated like to assimilate is an act of submission to this imperialistic American model that it's a negative.
Yeah, but does that even make sense? I mean, that to me, that doesn't make sense when you want to promote a nation, a community that gets along, that works together, that's united in their vision and their goals. How is that possible under multiculturalism? But you can see it happening. Like you said, the government went out of its way to help this family when they got over here. The father on a terrorism watch list. And what do? They take him off the list and they give him a job as a special policeman for Chattanooga's Department of Public Works. This is, I think, one of those programs where they're trying to reach out to the Muslim communities and say, you're accepted the way you are. We want to build bridges with you and to, you know, to help you, your community to stay the way it is, but bring more awareness to it, those sorts of things. But it obviously never worked with this family.
Now, if I understood you right, it almost seems like there's this element of playing up on the sense of grievance, and well, the government is coming after me, or because I am a minority, then I'm looked at with more suspicion and that type of thing, and that sense of grievance played into, from what we can tell, or from what you're describing, into why he lashed out the way he did.
That's very possible.
And that's another element that, again, that's encouraged and that's stirred up. And even the president is starting to kind of play into this idea that, there's a almost justification for the anger and the animosity or the animus against the prevailing culture within the country because, well, it's seen as a hostile force against your native identity.
Right. And we saw this in the media a lot over the years, just as the self-loathing of America and our ideals. And, you know, we went to the Middle East because we wanted the oil and this and that and all this kind of things. And that these people naturally have a right to be angry with us. You know, we saw in the media that, and even in this case, but especially in previous cases, we saw them pretending like the greatest danger in this war on terror is increased discrimination against these peaceful Muslims. Like they talked like the biggest danger for America is if, you know, suddenly there's going to be the discrimination against Muslims. Well, we don't see people going out there and attacking Muslims and going into their mosques and shooting people up. That doesn't happen in America. At least to this point, we haven't seen that. But what we are seeing is individuals refusing to conform to an American identity, adopt American ideals, and attacking our forces, our military here in America. So to me, the biggest danger is this political correctness and refusing to admit the danger that our immigration policy is putting the nation in. And you can tell that to the families of those soldiers who died. One of them had Purple Hearts, teenager was another one. And it's a very, very sad situation.
Well, thank you, Robert, for that. We're going to turn now to Asia and to Jeremiah Jacques. We'll start with the overview of the headlines from this region.
Japan's lower house passed a bill on Thursday that gives the Japanese military a freer hand to fight. And this is really significant because the new bill basically says that Japan can fight in foreign conflicts for the first time since World War II. So a lot of people in Japan are protesting this, and there are still some legal hurdles that the bill has to pass, but it looks like Japan is really on the fast track to becoming a full-fledged military power once again.
Just real briefly, can you give us a sense of, you talked about protests, is there a split between, say, leaders who are trying to push for greater freedom with their military and the people who are maybe more pacifist mindset, or is it just a contingent within the population?
Primarily, it's the former. The population, for the most part, likes the economic benefits that come from Japan's sort of insular military policy. They don't have to make all these expenditures that a lot of other countries have to make. Article 9 has really been a huge boon to Japan's economy. And so a lot of people say, why do we want to change that? The U.S. protects us. Let's just go on being a pacifistic nation. Let's keep on relying on America for security assurances. But the leadership, particularly Shinzo Abe, says, well, he sees America sort of becoming an unreliable ally. He and a lot of the more hawkish leaders, and they say it's time for Japan to be able to stand up against China, against North Korea, other countries like that.
Another overview story.
Okay, yes. Well, North Korea also made headlines this week when the United States said that it is ready to make a nuclear deal with North Korea, possibly similar to the landmark deal with Iran that was finalized this week.
I thought we already made a deal with them.
We did, yeah. Just back in the mid-90s, President Bill Clinton made a deal with the North Koreans, and basically it said, very similar to what we've seen with Iran, it said it will allow nuclear inspections of all their facilities, and it will freeze the development of North Korea's nuclear weapons.
That didn't work out so well.
It didn't. Just a few years after that, the country went right on to develop nuclear weapons, and since then it's repeatedly threatened its neighbors and America and many others with detonating these nukes on them.
Now they say we're ready to, it's for real this time.
Right, right. Let's give it another try, round two. And the timing of this is a little bit odd, but with the United States making concessions to so many nations that hate America, you know, Cuba, Iran, then I guess we shouldn't really be surprised to see North Korea next on the list.
So the big story, Jeremiah, from this week.
The big story is that Russia is continuing its slow advance into the Republic of Georgia. Our listeners may remember that back in 2008, Russia fought a war with Georgia. There were two Georgian states or regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, which wanted to break off from Georgia and to instead become aligned with Russia. And so Georgia fought to keep those two states unified with the rest of the country, but the Russian military, unsurprisingly, overpowered the Georgian forces. And after 5 days of conflict, the Russians won. And so ever since then, in everything but name, those two states have been a part of Russia. And Russia leaves plenty of its forces in those two regions to ensure that Moscow can maintain its control, its de facto control over them. So what happened this week is that those forces in South Ossetia moved the border south. They moved about a mile in some places, about a mile and a half in other places. There were a series of signs just sort of designating the line between the Russia-controlled area and the Georgia-controlled area. And they just physically uplifted those, uprooted them, and moved them south. And it basically expanded Russia's territory, and not in an arbitrary place either. This new strip of land that came under Russia's control includes part of a major oil pipeline. So it's a very strategic chunk of land there. And Georgia is calling on the international community to properly respond to these provocative moves by Russia. Georgian authorities call this a creeping annexation of their country. And they wonder, when is this going to stop? Or will it stop? And on the Trumpet Hour, we've talked before about Putin's strategy of expanding Russia's territory, this wait, invade, wait, kind of a strategy. And this is just another powerful example of that happening. It's this slow and steady wins the race kind of mentality that we see in Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Maybe even a little bit of while the world is looking elsewhere and huge headlines are being made in all of these other theaters, that's a good time to act.
That's very true, yes. I think he welcomes those distractions because he knows that he's able to push with impunity. And Putin knows that if he's gradual, whether it's in Georgia, in Ukraine, in Transnistria, in other theaters, he can avoid any real response from NATO or the international community. I spoke yesterday with one of the Trumpet's contacts in Tbilisi, Georgia, the capital city there. He's a political commentator named Dr. Irakli Bokuchava. And he said that he thinks this border move is really significant. He also said that Georgian journalists waited until a certain part of this this newly moved border was left unguarded. And these journalists came through and they tore down the signs, the newly moved signs. And so Dr. Irakli said that he really wishes Georgia's politicians were as bold as those journalists mm-hmm. were. Because, of course, the Russian-controlled troops quickly put the signs right back up. And now they're not letting any Georgians have access to the land there. And I just wanted to remind our readers, in light of this new development, about a story that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote back in 2008, just after that war happened. And I want to read a short excerpt from his article. It says, "Russia's attack on Georgia marks the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. This was the first military strike of a rising superpower, and there will be more. Today you have Western leaders," he's saying this back in 2008, "today you have Western leaders trying to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. I don't believe Russia will ever allow that to happen. Will a crisis occur over Ukraine? Surely Russia is willing to wage war over that." Just knowing that that was written in 2008 and knowing everything that's happened since then in Ukraine, in Georgia, it's just that time has really proven that forecast to have been stunningly accurate. And I would just encourage listeners to read that article. You can easily find it if you just Google the title, "Russia's Attack Signals Dangerous New Era." It was the cover story from the Trumpet's October 2008 issue.
Huge cover story. I remember when we initially published that, just what had happened in Georgia was so dramatic. And, you know, we've been just going back and back and pointing to how dangerous this aggressive posture that Russia has been taking under Vladimir Putin really is, how much it's shaping Asia, how much it's shaping Europe, ultimately. Yeah, excellent, excellent material. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to get a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly, this article that Jeremiah was just referencing about what happened this week in Georgia is in this week's edition, and also a link to that article of Mr. Fleury's that he referenced. Coming up next, we will have our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll start with Richard.
Well, one slightly less important aspect of the Greek story is that in putting together the latest Greek bailout, the EU is also pushing Britain out. So to give some backstory here, in the original Greek bailout, Britain was actually part of that bailout in loaning Greece money. And that made a lot of people over here pretty angry. You know, they were saying, well, what in the world? We didn't join the euro because we thought it was a bad idea. And now it's all gone horribly wrong, and we've been proved right. You want us to help you pay the bill? And so very early on in his prime ministership, Prime Minister David Cameron got a supposedly cast-iron guarantee from the European Commission that this bailout fund that included Britain would never be used again, so that British money would never again be used to bail out the euro. And since then, the government has paraded this achievement out as proof that the EU can be reasonable, that Britain can negotiate with the EU, and that Britain can win concessions from the EU. And they've said, basically, look, we don't need to leave the EU. This is one area where we've proven that we can negotiate with the European Union, and there are other areas. And so we can negotiate, we can get a better deal, be in a better place within Europe without having to leave. And then this week, the EU completely turned around and went back on its word. They broke that promise, and they're using the bailout that Britain thought had an actual legal guarantee would not be used. And Britain will get, it looks like, some kind of compensation for that, or collateral or something. the fact remains that the European Commission has gone back on its word, and that's going to make it much harder now to convince British voters that they can negotiate with Europe, especially when Europe gives them a cast iron guarantee that they then break. It shows that there's not a partner here that they can negotiate with in good faith.
So the pro-Europe position, the ground under their feet begins to get even shakier. The Eurosceptic position is stronger. Pretty remarkable aspect of that story. Thank you. We'll turn now to Brent. He also recorded this yesterday for us. Here's what Brent had to say about another important item from the Middle East.
Well, my second story relates to the nuclear deal as well, and it looks like that the day the deal was signed, there was already nations lining up to do business with Iran. Now, we know that the windfall that they'll receive for signing, the signing bonus, is about their frozen assets or their cash that was frozen that they'll now receive. But then going forward, you have their economy being opened up to other markets, to people wanting to export all kinds of things. We had the Iranian foreign minister who invited the French foreign minister down to Iran. This was the day after the deal was signed, to come and negotiate different economic deals. And then I think it was yesterday or the day before that we had Iran saying that they had already negotiated to buy new airlines or new airplanes from Boeing and Airbus. Now, they haven't been able to buy a new airplane since the early 1990s. But now the deal's open. A lot of American companies are wanting to go to Iran. A lot of German, French, and of course the Russians, they'll be in there as quick as they can. The Chinese are also trying to get in there. So this is just a wonderful cash bonanza, not just for Iran, but all these other countries that see this developing market that's about to be opened up to them. I think it's 70 million people that are going to be hungry for Western goods because Western countries haven't been able to deal with them.
And this is technically before the sanctions are even lifted.
Right, they're not lifted for another 6 months or so, 3 to 6 months. So you see, what can this do to Iran? We've talked about the $100 billion or $150 billion that they'll get, but this is on top of that. And we've already discussed how they use their money, and it's not just for building up their sad economy. It's for their nefarious acts all over the region.
We'll turn now to Robert, your second most important story.
Well, this week, President Obama wrote personal letters to 46 felons and commuted their prison sentences. President Obama has now commuted more prison sentences of criminals than the last four presidents combined. Meanwhile, critics are noting that the president hasn't reached out or even tried to contact Catherine Steinle's family. If you remember, Catherine was that innocent vacationer in San Francisco who was murdered by an illegal alien, who was also a convicted felon, who was then released from prison and was not deported. Earlier this year, he had actually been deported five times previous, but had returned each of those times. And critics are asking, you know, why hasn't the president even sent condolences to her family or even mentioned that issue? And they say, well, you remember the case with Michael Brown, this thug from Ferguson who attacked a police officer, charged at him and was killed. The president was very quick to reach out to his family and the community in Ferguson, and he's done similar things with other cases. But here's a case where an innocent bystander gets killed. And obviously, critics are trying to bring out this point or highlight the point that the president isn't reaching out because he isn't going to bring attention to a death that was caused by a policy that his administration promotes and is actively working to actually increase the ability of illegals to stay in the United States.
Thank you, Robert. Now to Jeremiah.
The Russian government approved plans this week to build a bridge connecting the Russian mainland to the Crimean Peninsula. The Crimean Peninsula was Ukrainian territory until just last March when it was absorbed into the Russian Federation, and now Russia wants to connect its mainland to this new strategic acquisition. So reports say that the new bridge will be about 12 miles long, and it'll accommodate a rail line and also about four lanes of car traffic, and at a cost of $4 billion, it's supposed to be the most expensive bridge Russia has ever built. I think this is really significant because this bridge project could allay a lot of suspicions among Westerners who have speculated that Russia needs some of those eastern Ukrainian territories in order to build sort of a land bridge connecting the Russian mainland to the Crimean Peninsula. Now, since they're building an actual bridge over the water there, it could, you know, it could allay some of those concerns, and people could say, look, Russia doesn't need a land bridge anymore. It has an actual bridge. I think it's interesting that the Trumpet actually wrote about this bridge project back in January, the very first time the plans were mentioned. And a couple of Russian newspapers, big newspapers, picked up the Trumpet story because we made that little analysis. We said, maybe this means they don't need a land bridge. And the Russian press loved that. They said, yes, look, a Western news source, thetrumpet.com, is saying Russia no longer needs a land bridge because we're building this bridge over the water. And so they published that pretty broadly, and it brought a lot of traffic to thetrumpet.com. I don't know if that means that it's not true or that it is true. It's hard to say with the Russian press. Their media is very much a mouthpiece for the government, and they like to sow a lot of confusion at times. But it's an interesting development to keep our eyes on.
I just want to conclude with an article or something that happened this last week that I thought was pretty awesome in a way. The New Horizons spacecraft flew very close to Pluto. This is the fastest spacecraft that we've ever launched. It left Earth so fast, it shot past the moon in 9 hours. And now it's been flying for 9.5 years. I think it's something like 8 billion miles to get to Pluto, and this is an extraordinary accomplishment engineering wise. The fact that they were able to shoot this out there and hit Pluto 9.5 years later at really exactly the right time, where it takes maybe a couple hundred years for Pluto to make one revolution around the sun. But this is where it's closest, where it would be easiest for us to hit. And, you know, the distance that it is away from Earth now, it takes something like 4.5 hours for a message to reach the spacecraft. So they can't steer it. They can't navigate it as it's approaching Pluto. But here we are, we've gotten just a couple, they've released just a couple of little images that give you an idea of just how amazing a view of this little dwarf planet that we're going to get. I think they're going to be releasing information here over the next few months. But Alan Stern, in a New York Times documentary, he's a principal investigator in this project. He says, we're not planning to rewrite any textbooks. We're planning to write them from scratch. That's how little that we knew. We didn't even know Pluto existed until about 85 years ago. And now we have these pictures from very close to the planet. I think the achievement is phenomenal. It's awesome to see these scientists that are celebrating what they have done, but I think it's just wonderful to see the curiosity that humankind has about what is going on out there, about our solar system, about the universe, about the cosmos, and we want to explore. We want to know, what does it look like? We want to see what's out there, not just in science fiction, not just through, you know, all of the blockbuster movies, the Star Treks and the Star Wars and all of that, but in our space program, really actually building spacecraft that can go out and look to the explore to the very outer limits of our solar system. And of course, this spacecraft is going to keep on going and explore the asteroid belt outside of the solar system and so on. But this story really brings to mind what the Bible says about the universe and the fact that there is a reason for all of that, that God created the universe for a reason, and it's an awesome reason, and it's one that really should fire the imaginations of every single person on Earth. I think it's really cool when something like this takes place, and it does stir us, it does fire our imaginations, and it points us to something beautiful and awesome and stunning. We have a booklet called Our Awesome Universe Potential. It's available on thetrumpet.com through our literature library that explains what that is and just goes through the Bible and talks about why that real estate is out there and what God's plans for it are in the future. It's a wonderful thing to set your mind on. we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've talked about on the program today are all in there. We've got links to other Trumpet articles that give you greater explanation and context for what's going on. We want to help you to understand what's happening in the world, and particularly in these very urgent times with just so much going on that demands explanation. So go there and look up that Trumpet Weekly news report, and you can receive it free in your email inbox every week. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook and Google Plus. Just search for the Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to our panel, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Stephen Hawking. He said, "Look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.